Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. An organization developed to assist in preventing campus sexual assault is the focus in Brookings tonight. Annie E. Clark is one of the co-founders of End Rape on Campus, an organization that provides assistance to survivors of gender-based and sexual violence. End Rape on Campus sees a world where people experience education free from violence. She joins us today inside the Janine Basinger studio at South Dakota State University. Annie Clark, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thank you so much for having me.
This is one of those careers as an activist and a leader in a topic that you probably didn't think when you were younger, this is what I want to grow up to do. Tell us about how End Rape on Campus as an organization came into being.
Sure. End Rape on Campus was founded by a group of young student activists and leaders and about five, six years ago. And basically what we saw was a void in how students were being supported and fulfilling their educational equity and opportunity after experiencing violence. And we had a lot of amazing rape crisis shelters, domestic violence organizations around the country, but there was this very niche gap in supporting students, whether that be through K through 12 or in higher education. And so it really was formed out of necessity. A few of us got together and recognized that sexual violence is a problem in schools that affects 1 in 4 women, 1 in 16 men. And they didn't have anywhere to go that wasn't a lawyer, something that was very high priced. And we wanted to teach students about educational equity laws such as Title IX, which we can talk about a little bit later, to let them know that they had civil rights and could continue their education if they chose to do so.
How widespread is the problem when you say, you know, there's numbers, we know what those numbers are, at least, you know, is the best we can tell. But when you look at colleges and how they sort of deal with those numbers, deal with people reporting sexual violence on campus, the problem turns out to be a lot deeper than we realized.
Yeah, it's massive, and it's a cultural problem. And though we might hear about certain schools in the news, for example, Penn State or Baylor as having these problems, it's actually everywhere. It's just certain schools that are getting the headlines. And so to recognize that regardless of your zip code, that this problem is something that is happening. And so I'm really happy to be here in South Dakota to talk to students because it's not isolated to one campus. Every single news story you see is a microcosm of a much larger societal problem. And even though End Rape on Campus focuses primarily on higher education, we know that if we're starting to talk about this issue at 18, at campus orientation, it's way too late because we have students in our elementary and middle schools already experiencing sexual violence.
Let's talk about finding collective solutions. It's multifaceted. Where do you want to begin?
It is so multifaceted. I think we need to begin with awareness and people recognizing that they know survivors and that this is not an issue that is isolated. And I think there are many policy solutions, right? And one of the things End Rape on Campus does is look at policy at the local, municipal, school level, the state level, and the federal level. And one of those policies that we really push for is healthy relationship and consent education starting much earlier. And so there are policy solutions, but then there are also cultural change solutions. And so how we look at the media, how the TV our kids watch influences their ideas of consent is really important. And so you have this dualistic both policy and cultural change that needs to happen.
When you say you know survivors, and you know we're living in a Me Too era and a time when more and more women are coming forward, but many women I've talked to are also saying, you know, because of some of the things that are happening to women who are coming forward, they have a hesitation to tell their story. So how are women being treated when they tell their stories right now? How do we support people who tell their stories?
Yeah, Lori, that's a really excellent, excellent question. And particularly in this moment where people are being vilified for coming forward. We just looked at what happened with the recent Supreme Court hearings. And I've personally received, you know, death threats and rape threats just for talking. And so we live in a world where saying I believe you to a survivor is a radical act of activism, unfortunately. And so I don't feel like anybody should ever feel pressured to share their story. If they want to, that's okay. If they don't want to, that's okay. But I do obviously want to live in a world free from violence, but also one, if violence does happen, that we can have an open and honest conversation. And if somebody comes forward, then they are supported. And so what I would say to any survivor listening, or what I would tell somebody if a survivor tells them their story, are the three things of, it's not your fault, no matter what you were wearing, what you were drinking, what you were doing, it's not your fault. And I believe you, and you're not alone. And I think it's important for listeners to know what their local resources are, so they can share that variety of options. So if somebody shares with you that they are a survivor of domestic violence, sexual assault, that you can say, here's a menu of what you can do, here's how I can support you, but you don't dictate their decision for them. Mm-hmm. Because what we know is sexual violence is a crime about control and power, not about sex. And so making sure that you give that survivor control of how they want to move forward. And some people want to report, some people don't want to report. And that's okay. And making sure that all options are open and validated.
You talk about media training for journalists on how to appropriately cover some of these topics. What are some of the major missteps that you see in coverage of campus rape, campus sexual assault?
Yeah, I think it's very important for journalists to have an accurate understanding of not only the scope of the problem, but how to ask questions in a trauma-informed way. You can still get at the truth of a survivor's story or hearing them explain their own experiences without re-traumatizing them in many cases. And so instead of, you can start by saying, how much do you want to share? Or I'm here to listen and here's my obligation. And just having that backdrop and that framework of sharing what you're trying to write about, being very open and honest, honoring things when they are said off the record or on background, I think that's a really good start. And there's actually some academics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Dr. Barbara Friedman and Dr. Ann Johnson, who have done amazing work on this very topic. And do train their student journalists on how to ask questions to survivors and things like that. And I think that that's a good starting point. Another big misstep in the college arena, and this might be too in the weeds, but a lot of things we're seeing are happening around Title IX and issues with the Office for Civil Rights. And a lot of times that gets conflated to lawsuits. And even that word, people sort of jump out at and say, oh, you're suing for money, when actually this is a civil rights complaint and case. Mm-hmm. And so having journalists like do their homework and do their background research. And so doing all of that first and knowing what you're talking about, so you don't have to have a survivor actually explain the intricacies of their own legal case.
Sure. So you mentioned, people being vilified for coming forward, and I'm sure you heard much of this, and we heard it some on this show when people were talking about the Kavanaugh hearings and this notion of due process. And so you hear that a lot. When somebody comes forward, there's going to be somebody else who says, well, we need due process for the person who is accused. Walk us through a little bit about an understanding of things that have to play out, but yet the conversations that need to be had in order to support people who come forward and report sexual assault.
Yeah, absolutely. Another good question. And I think we, to take a step back, something we need to think about is the difference between the criminal legal justice system and a school adjudication system, right? And oftentimes, one, survivors don't go to the police for a variety of reasons. And we especially know this with survivors of color who are assaulted at a higher rate, yet less likely to be believed. So we're talking about, one, two separate systems, and then all of the barriers to reporting. And we know most people don't report. So we're talking about maybe 1-2% of people who even make it that far because there are so many barriers. But then when we get that far, when we have a Supreme Court hearing or a criminal case in court or we have a school hearing, those are all separate things that have separate issues around them. And in the school setting, oftentimes a survivor just wants to continue their education. They want things like academic support measures or extra time on a test or not having to sit across the dining room hall for their rape from their rapist or moving a dorm room. So we're not talking about the same things that we are in the criminal legal system. Therefore, they're separate processes that have different constitutional protections. And with the due process issue, I don't think really anybody's saying that due process is bad. We just want better training for everyone involved. And right now, your options are pretty much all bad, and they could all be better for all parties involved. And so when we talk about due process for all parties, I think that's completely a valid argument. But what I would like to see more of is trauma-informed training, because you have survivors going into these adjudication situations where they're being re-traumatized and asked questions that are entirely not only inappropriate, but don't show that the people asking them are educated in what trauma looks like. So an example of that would be if a survivor's memory of an experience is nonlinear, or if they happen to remember something later, or they don't show the appropriate emotion that the hearing adjudicator thinks that should be shown, because survivors experience a wide range of emotions, and some of them might be more emotional and some of them might be very matter of fact, and that's okay. But we have to have these people who are hearing these cases trained in trauma-informed ways. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a both and. I don't think people are arguing that we shouldn't treat people who are accused fairly, but I also think in the vast majority of the cases, survivors are the ones that are being treated unfairly, if that makes sense.
Yes. The author Alice Siebold was recently in Brookings, and we interviewed her for this show, and she also talked to students on campus, and I'm misquoting her a little bit, but the intention is the same. As, you know, she talked about revolutions being a little bit messy and how we're in a particular point in history. You started this organization a few years ago, and then you have the history unfold as it has over the past 5 years or so. Do you feel like we are in the middle of a time of upheaval where the conversation around sexual violence is moving forward, where people are figuring things out? What kind of historic moment do you sort of, when you step back and look at the big picture, see that you are working within?
Absolutely. And I think that first we have to acknowledge where we came from, right? You and I would not even be having the vocabulary to have this conversation had it not been for civil rights leaders in the 60s and the 20s and before, right? And so while we have come a long way and can openly talk about this now on the radio, we still have very, very far to go. I mean, we just put somebody on the Supreme Court after that hearing. Our president has openly admitted to assaulting women or wanting to assault women. And so, yeah, we're still we still have a lot of work to do, but we've even come a long way in the past 5 years. And so it's sometimes two steps forward, one step back.
I have a daughter who's getting ready for college, and as we do these college campus visits, it often comes up when you submit your questions or you're on a campus tour and they walk you by, you know, student safety or, you know, campus security. And it's interesting how different colleges sort of address the topic. So at one college we're at, the student leader said, you know, this is security, but, you know, don't take stupid chances, but really we don't have any problems here at this campus. And then another college, somebody, a parent asked a question, and the female student answered and gave us a lecture about personal responsibility. And I'm wondering, when you go to college campuses as a parent, as a student, what are some of those sort of red flags or positive, like what are you listening for when those conversations come up? What are you looking for to research an institution to find out really how they are handling prevention? How are they handling adjudication? How are they handling the topic as a whole?
Right. I think that's a question a lot of parents have right now, particularly because it's been highlighted in the media so much. And I think a major red flag is illustrated by a study that Inside Higher Ed did, I believe. And I think it was either them or the Chronicle, so don't quote me on that.
Sure.
But over 90% of college presidents said sexual violence was a major issue. Over 90% of college presidents said sexual violence is not a major issue on my campus. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a real leadership problem where we're acknowledging that this exists, but not on my campus. And an interesting example of that is also colleges are required by federal law to submit something called a Cleary report every year, where they list the number of crimes that happen on campus, and they range from things like arson to stalking to sexual violence. And a lot of parents will look at that Cleary report and say, wow, zero instances of sexual violence. That means that campus is safe. And I always see zero in reported crimes as a red flag, because that means the school is either intentionally underreporting, unintentionally underreporting and doesn't really know what they're doing, and maybe it's just not malicious, or students don't feel safe coming forward. Because statistically, we know at a school with 50,000 students, if you have zero reported instances of sexual violence, that's not an indicator of safety. In fact, it's just the opposite. And so that's one of my big red flags.
And what can you do about it? So that's the school that you're already at. That's the school that you want to go to. And this goes back to, you know, sort of the mission of, you know, you have a right to have an education experience free of sexual violence, free of the threat of it. What do you do if you see some of those red flags, or you have a student, or you are that student who is enrolled somewhere and you're looking around, your friends are coming forward, you see, mm-hmm. you know, issues. Gosh, where do you begin?
Yeah, it's a big question.
Yeah.
And I think just having that information and knowing it, and students have a lot of power, more than they know, to hold their administrators accountable. And you can hold them accountable in different ways, right? You need students who are going to protest, and you need people who are going to write nice, polite emails to the chancellor and have a meeting about it, right? So you need the policy change, you need the culture change. And this is also a moment where we shouldn't just be talking to our young girls, we need to be talking to our young boys. And there needs to be a thematic framework shift in how we talk about this issue in terms of not protecting our young girls, but how do our young boys treat each other, right? And it starts in kindergarten, right? You hear, and there's a lot of unlearning to do in college, but for example, and I'll probably share this with some of the students tonight, but my younger sister is a kindergarten teacher. She hears on the playground, he's chasing you because he likes you. He's throwing sand at you because he thinks you're cute. Oh, boys will be boys. Fast forward to middle school, and we have young girls being taken out of their classrooms because their bra straps are showing and their collarbones are distracting and their shorts are too short. And that message sends to young girls, you're not worthy of learning. And then it sends to young boys, you can't control yourselves. And obviously, this isn't a very heteronormative framework, which is problematic to begin with. But when we're taking girls out of their learning environment, starting when they're 12 and 13, and then telling boys that they're being distracted and can't control themselves, and then you fast forward and a sexual assault or something happens, and then they're sitting, you know, reporting, and then they get the question asked, what were you wearing? And so we've got to look at sexual violence and all of these issues of sexism, racism, homophobia, transphobia, et cetera, on a spectrum, right? It's not a one-time isolated instance. So going back to your initial question of what can you do, it's calling out all of those little things that normalize a culture where sexual violence is acceptable. It is when you're sitting down with your buddies and a commercial comes on saying, hey, that's not cool. It's all of those little everyday activism things, which is a term coined by my co-founder, Andrea, that really shift culture. And so we do have policies, but the policies have to be, one, be implemented, And then we also need those day-to-day interactions that say, hey, that's not cool. So bystander intervention is often talked about a one-time thing on a Friday night where you go in and quote-unquote save someone. But it's really more than that. It's about calling out those every single day behaviors that we might not think are related but contribute to the normalization of violence.
Annie E. Clark is one of the co-founders of End Rape on Campus. She's in Brookings tonight for the SDSU Speaker Series. That is tonight at 7 o'clock in the Performing Arts Center at Larson Memorial Concert Hall. Any final thoughts, Annie, about tonight's conversation that you'd like to leave us with?
I hope students and community members come out, and I hope that even if you don't think you have a relationship to this issue, you do. And so just to be aware, and then finally I'll reiterate what I said previously to any survivors listening. If you've never heard these words before, it's not your fault. You are not alone, and I believe you. Thank you so much, Lori, for having me.
Thanks, Annie. The website is endrapeoncampus.org, and she joined us from the Janine Basinger Studio at South Dakota State University.